Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Heather Morris, the author of The Tattooist of Auschwitz. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you so much. Absolute delight to be talking with you.
As the name would suggest, your novel is a fictionalized version of a man, Lael Sokolov, who was a tattooist at Auschwitz.
Yes, Lully. They call him Lully.
Lully.
He calls himself Lully. It is. And yes, it's created quite a sort of stir around the place. Why have you written the true story of somebody and it's been labelled as fiction? Well, hopefully historical fiction. And to me, it's very simple. When I initially started to write the book and I was asked to write the book by the publishers, I thought about a memoir. That seemed the logical way to go. I even went to memoir school for a day. Mm-hmm. Came away saying, no, this is not going to give me the method, the way I want to tell the story. So even a biography was rejected. To do those, I would not be able to include Geeta, this woman who I never met, and to be able to put dreams and thoughts and fears into her. Otherwise, I was just telling Lale's story. So we agreed, fictionalise it where you can. But I have to say that everything in it happened. It was witnessed, seen, experienced by Lale. The timelines are totally accurate with regard to what was going on in Auschwitz-Birkenau at the time. I have chosen to weave this love story into those timelines.
Especially because it is an astonishing love story.
Is indeed. Romeo and Juliet, eat your heart out.
I mean, there is... I don't want to give too much of that aspect of it away, because there is, out of Auschwitz, which I don't think you can, it hasn't become a stereotype, but we do all have ideas of the horror, the constant death, the constant fear, the starvation, the...
Dehumanizing.
The dehumanizing element. And yet there is this love story that has incredible serendipitous elements to it, like magic.
And look, I actually don't mind giving away the spoiler that it has a happy ending. Okay, so we can get that up front.
Yes, we can get that up front. And this was, there was one thing you mentioned, dehumanizing. And a lot of the serendipitous aspects of it hinge upon the fact that Geeta, Lale's wife, as she eventually becomes, who he met in the camps when he tattooed her.
Yes.
With a number that replaced her personhood.
Yes.
And she says that she is not going to tell him her last name.
And she doesn't.
She does not tell him her last name. And it's, to me, it was so powerful because what he gives her is the replacement. He gives her a number instead of a name. And until she's human again, until she has personhood back,
and
she will not tell him.
She's out of that place.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it was one of the reasons he persevered and persevered, along with the fact that he'd fallen hopelessly in love with her. But when she would say to him, I am just a number, you know, you gave it to me. It would hit him hard every time he said he heard that. I'm just a number. I'm just a number.
And he is the instrument of that number.
He is.
And the constant fear that they lived with, because as the tattooist, he... I mean, it's also a wonderful story of survival and how commerce and... And human interaction and human commerce happens at any time, because the Nazis were taking everyone's, all the Jews and other people interned in the camp, all their possessions. Lale was able to secrete away some of these possessions, sell them for food, and distribute that amongst...
Look, he was an opportunist.
Yeah.
And in today's... way you were thinking,
entrepreneur,
opportunist, and that could be seen as a good or a bad thing. Under the circumstances, I think it can only be seen as a very good thing. He was also manipulative. He was smart, he was street savvy. He had so many of the attributes going for him that enabled him to always step outside, he said, his block, and before he took another step, assess, where are the dangers? Where am I? Who's around? Never barge into anything. But then on the other hand, he was taking these stupid risks as well to get to know Geeta.
He and said to keep her and her friends fed. And it's amazing because that fear stayed with him the rest of his life because he was an instrument of the Nazis. And while it is true to say if he didn't do it, someone else will, that sounds very similar to I was following orders.
Yes, it does. The exception being that when you're a prisoner, that's quite different to being in the army or being a soldier. Yeah, the thing with, how can I explain it? Lully took the job as the tattooist, the tattoo bearer, in the hope that he could make things easier for those people who he would upnumber. He called it numbering. He numbered people. I was in Auschwitz this time last week, and I was listening to a rabbi from Florida talk to a group of students. I was just one of the audience listening. And I heard him saying how in Florida, where he lived, there were two ladies who lived nearby him who were survivors. And as I say, he didn't know me, didn't know I was there, didn't even know about my book. And he said, you know, one of the things they said to me when he talked to them, you know, when the tattooist, the person who made my numbers, was doing it, he kept apologizing and kept saying he was sorry. I never heard that until last week, that this is how the girls in particular were treated by him. I presumed they were, but to hear it in Poland from a rabbi from Florida to this girl from Melbourne, yeah, pretty amazing.
It's, as I say, one of my mother's friends, Irmgard, who just recently passed, but she was a survivor of Auschwitz, and so I feel sort of personally touched by Lally's story as well.
I bet you do.
And she never wore short sleeves, ever.
Oh, really?
And she'd had it removed, but she never wore short sleeves. But to know that there was one small kindness in that hell.
You know, Geeta got to be 68 years of age, and she woke up one morning and she turned to Lally and she said, get rid of it. I do not want to wake up one more morning with this number on my arm.
Wow.
For 10 years before she died, at the age of 68, he went and found a plastic surgeon and removed her number. He kept his, but it's just amazing how after all those years, decades, all of a sudden it hit her hard.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that a bit too, because he was, and they were quite fearful of reprisals, because he did have, you know, this tricky position.
Yeah.
Why did he want to then tell his story?
You know, he never shied away from the fact that he was a privileged prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it. He wasn't the only one. There were many people who had skills that the SS used, and they did become privileged. But he used that privilege. Now, we knew, getting around to talking about, did that make him a collaborator? Not one part of my body, not one fibre of my body could ever even see him in that light. You know, he didn't either.
And but that comes across in the book, because as a reader, I was surprised. I was like, oh, wow. Oh, crumbs. I hadn't thought about that aspect of it.
No, but what he was afraid of, if his story became well known, and I've got to tell you, everybody in Melbourne and people I met in Sydney, survivors, friends of survivors, family of survivors, they never ever looked at him in any other way but this amazing, wonderful man. However, as long as there was the chance that one person somewhere in the world would point a finger at him and say, you were a collaborator, and Geeta was alive, and there could be any embarrassment brought to her through what he had done, he would not hear of that. So yes, it was her death.
I had a feeling that it was her death, that he no longer had to protect her.
Exactly. I think Geeta, from what I know of her, would say, you never had to protect me.
Exactly.
I was very capable of looking
you.
After myself.
Exactly.
You know? And she was.
She seemed quite a formidable woman.
She was.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And her relationship with another girl in the camp, Silke in particular, from the research that we've uncovered, actually gave her that little bit of a privileged prisoner status as well. But when you consider that Lully survived as a man aged 26 in a camp with privileges, and then you consider that Geeta, an 18-year-old girl, living the same hell, and she survived, hats off to Geeta.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's amazing.
And while he didn't want to advertise this story while Geeta was alive, did their son know?
He knew as much as his father was prepared to tell him. Mm-hmm. He knew that he had been the tattooer, the tattooist, because he would hear all the men talking every Friday night. And when they gathered, it was like he said, the women would go into one room and never mention it, but the men relived it time and time again. And he used to stand in the doorway and listen. So he knew, but he didn't know everything, of course. Now, Geeta never spoke to their son, Gary, about it. She was a closed book.
Many survivors did not talk about
it. That's the way they were. Lully said that when Gary was a teenager, a documentary series came on in Australia called The World at War. And he said to him, you're going to sit down every week and you're going to watch this program. Your mother and I aren't going to watch it with you. But when it's over, I will answer any questions that you have. So that was Lully's way of telling his son, or as much as he could. He said, oh, typical boy. He said, he's 13 or 14, and he watches the first episode, and Lully approaches him with apprehension. Okay, what are you going to ask? And all Gary's interested in is, hey, what size were those guns that the Germans had, Dad? Yeah, typical teenage boy, it was all about the weaponry. And Lully said he was somewhat relieved. But he did tell him, and ultimately Gary learned more about his parents when he read my manuscript. But one of the things I was so touched by was when Gary did read it, and he rang me up when he'd finished it, and his first comment to me was, how did you get my mother so well when you never met her? I said, thank you, Dad. Thank you, Dad.
For that vivid picture.
Yes.
How did this story come to you?
Through the craziest... When I think about the things that could have happened that were not to come to me, it probably scares me. I was having coffee with a friend, sitting outside on a beautiful summer's day, early summer's day in Melbourne, and my friend said to me, oh, I've got this friend Gary whose mum's just died, and his dad wants to tell his story to somebody, but he wants somebody who's not Jewish. And she said, you're not Jewish. She said, would you like to go and meet him?
Why did he want someone not Jewish?
Very, very clear on that. In my first meeting, he made that very clear to me too. He wanted to tell his story to somebody who had no baggage,
mm-hmm.
who had no family history, who had no association with the Holocaust whatsoever.
No axe to grind. Yeah.
No axe to grind, no personal insights to bring to it. And in me, he got that. the Anglo-Saxon brought up in a town, in a small town in New Zealand with a population of 100, and when he said to me, did you have a synagogue in your town? I said, no.
No.
I said, we only had 100 people, Lully. I said, but when I think about it, we had every other Christian denomination church on every corner. And he said, what about the next town to you? Was there a synagogue there? And I said, no, I'm pretty sure there wasn't. Okay. Yeah, you'll do for now. But, you know, ultimately, when we started this process, and for many weeks, what Lully was telling me was just that clinical side of what he had experienced and witnessed.
Mm.
I wasn't getting the unburdening, the deep emotional story that I did ultimately get. And so when you ask, how did I get the story? Well, I got it from having coffee with my friend that at any point either one of us could have cancelled on. But more importantly, I got it thanks to his dogs. He had two dogs. One was the size of a small pony, and one was smaller than my cat. And whenever we sat in his lounge room, one of them would bring a tennis ball and he'd throw it over his shoulder and they'd retrieve it and knock furniture flying. And this would go on throughout the whole time. They'd have a rest, repeat. And about 3 months into our relationship or friendship, One day the big dog Tootsie brought the tennis ball and Lolly reached down to take it out of her mouth and she growled at him. So he smacked her and said, "Bad Tootsie, give me the ball." He tried again and the dog growled again, and then the dog turned away from him and came and laid her head on my knee. So I gently put my hand down into the dog's mouth and let go of the ball, and I threw it over my shoulder, but there went a lamp. But at that moment, Lolly turned to me and went, "Ah, my doggies like you. I like you. You can tell my story." And that was the moment that he then started welling up with tears and telling his story.
Trust.
Trust from the dogs. I had to pass the test of the dogs.
Ours?
No. I don't think he knew I had to pass the test, but...
Exactly. It showed him something.
It showed him something.
And it gave him an assurance.
Yeah.
And allowed him to finally break that open.
And probably the fact that I kept knocking on his door.
Persistence. Showing up is a big thing.
Absolutely.
Well, fantastic. So wait, you tried to make this into a film because you've had experience writing scripts.
Yes.
Which is, I assume, another reason why your friend said, you know, go find out the story.
Yes.
That proved very difficult. And it does seem very filmic.
Oh, absolutely. And I could see it played out on a screen, big or small. And the fact that I had studied writing screenplays, I knew the formula for writing a screenplay. I knew what was required in developing emotional arcs and when you had to hit notes. And so all that was ingrained in me. And so that made it very easy in some ways once I started getting the story to draft it into a screenplay. And, you know, in hindsight, I think, you stupid fool. You know, why did you spend so long fixated on the screenplay? And we'll jump forward a few years, and I was visiting my brother and sister-in-law in San Diego and had a few drinks one night, all of us sitting around the table, as you do. And I was bemoaning the fact that those buggers 100 miles up the road in Hollywood, you know, didn't know a decent story when it hit them over the head. And my sister-in-law just leaned over the table, looked me in the eye and went, "Oh, for God's sake, Heather, just write it as a book and get on with it." You know, it was a light bulb moment.
Well, to make it yours, it was your story.
What had I been thinking?
Yes, Lolly had given you this story and he entrusted this story to you.
Look, it had actually been optioned for 5 years by a film company in Melbourne, and when screenplays are optioned, you lose all control. Other than helping them develop the script. So there had been those 5 years when I hadn't been able to touch it anyway. And then I said, "No, I'm having it back." And so then it was, okay, how do you write a book? Good point. The first words from my publishers after they read the first draft, by the way, was, "You don't know what you're doing, do you?" No, I never pretended to be a writer.
Well, you've learned.
I've learned.
And we get Lolly's story.
Yes.
And Geeta's.
And Geeta's. And, you know, I have to give the biggest shout out to my editor, Angela Meyer, in Melbourne, as she was the one who saw my Kickstarter campaign and contacted me and sat down with me and went, "Wow, let me help you tell the story."
Excellent. And I'm so very glad she did.
Yes, me too.
Thank you so much, Heather.
My absolute pleasure.
This podcast was presented by Donna Freed and produced by Donna Freed.